Welcome to the Bitter End Podcast. Come on in and know me better, man. My name is Tom Denny.
And my name is Todd Jordan. Oh, come all ye faithful. Whether it be Christmas and the time of Yuletide giving when you listen to this podcast, or whether it be the height of summer, I give not one single shit.
That's right. We are here getting festive up the wazoo as we get to the bitter end of the Home Alone franchise with Home Alone, not five, just Home Alone, the Holiday Heist.
Now, very crucially, guys, if you have tuned in just for this episode because you are a big fan of Home Alone 5 and you want to hear what we have to say about this movie only, I would strongly recommend that you go back to the start of Season 5 because we have laid down some heavy lore that is going to go way over your head, people.
Yeah, we went deep down, like E17 in the last episode. Sorry, that is a weird reference to drop in the podcast. I don't care, but we're going some places with this, and places that I never thought that this franchise would take us. I'm very excited to see how this one ends.
Yeah, because from the trailer, it kind of looks like more of the same. So this one was made for TV.
Again, so yeah.
The only trailer that we could find was an actual TV spot going, tune in Saturday night at 8 for the holiday family event of the decade. That's right, it's Home Alone 5. We got some new baddies, we got a new kid. He looks like he's 21 fucking years old, but he's still acting like he's Kevin McAllister because, hey, what the fuck? All right, everybody's sitting down. Right, we'll start the movie or fucking whatever. I don't know, I'm out of here.
Yeah, it's like there's absolutely nothing in it to distinguish it from any of the other films. They even like have the bit of like the kid going down a sled on the stairs. No idea, absolutely no fucking idea what is coming in this film.
Does this movie even have an IMDb score, Tom?
It does, Todd. I'm glad you asked, because it's just here in time for a festive version of the IMDb guessing game.
Well, lay it on me, brother.
Okay, well, this film follows on from Home Alone 4, which came out in 2002. The Holiday Heist came out in 2012. They have had 10 years to think about this piece of shit.
A whole decade. Hey, Tom, do not judge it before you've seen it.
No, sorry. I meant piece of shit just figuratively, like as a mass, not as a judgment of quality.
The festive Christmas piece of shit.
Yeah, I don't want to colour the score that you give me for the game. So just for context, though, the last film got a 2.5. Mm. That is low down there.
That is low down, and I enjoyed it very, very much.
Now, what do you think that this one's got? They've had 10 years.
I am going to lay on my previous experience, Tom, because this is the eighth time we've reached the bitter end.
Mm-hmm.
Season 8, buddy.
Yeah, I know. It's been a long road.
It's taught me some things about IMDb. And one of the things it's taught me is that you can't get much lower than a 2.5.
Yeah, that's really low.
Unless your name is Clive Turner.
Yeah.
And it's also taught me that movies that come out quite recently tend to start with a higher score,
mm-hmm.
which drops over time. So I'm going to go big and hard, and I'm going to say 4.5, which I think is high.
Man, I admire your moxie. That is a big old score. Now, it is not as high as that.
Oh, my God.
We have gone up.
Okay.
And it is a 3.7. And I think that is a far more respectable place to end a franchise on.
Oh, yes. That is my comfort zone, son.
Yeah. Oh, it's going to be some snuggly Christmas slippers. This is a roaring fire. This is a big old glass of eggnog.
All right. Well, pour me a pint of sprouts and cut me a slice of nog. Let's go. All right!
Yeah, Merry Christmas, you filthy animal. We did it.
Season 8, The Bitter End, Home Alone, we made it.
Who else out there can say that they've watched all five Home Alone films?
Probably a lot of parents of, like, young children.
Yes, but certainly no one that has worked on all of the films.
Yes, I get that feeling, right?
But then with this one, I feel that the people who made this, they've actually watched some of them, the previous ones. There's some little knowing winks, some, you know, some gags for the camera.
There is a gag at the end, which is so funny.
Yeah.
That I actually laughed harder than any joke, say, from Police Academy.
I actually found this one, like, it has its faults and can be a little bit sort of, the kid can be a bit annoying, it can be a little bit slow and boring, but there's actually some, like, genuinely funny bits
yeah.
that are not the slapstick necessarily. It's just like just little gags in the writing. I'm like, yeah, fair. Yeah, yeah, cool.
Straight up, you know who I love most of all?
Who?
The dad.
Oh, fuck, the dad is amazing. So the dad, yeah.
Right.
I just kept on thinking, like, this isn't Chris Parnell, is it? Like,
Yeah, I know, from, he's like the voice of Cyril Figgis in Archer.
Yeah, and he's Dr. Spaceman in 30 Rock.
Okay, and other listeners might know him as Jerry from Rick and Morty.
Yeah, he's great. This, like, that is, he's not...
It's not
that,
Chris Parnell.
But it is as close as you're gonna get, and yeah. he is great.
In my notes, I've called him budget Jason Bateman.
Yep, yep,
he's
that's
got, he's
also...
He's got that real vibe, and he always wears a shirt and a tie and then a jumper over both. And he's always making fun little gags to himself and just talking in, like, strange accents from scene to scene, literally just to amuse himself. And he's yeah. adorable. He's so wholesome.
Super wholesome, yeah. Actually, the supporting cast in this is... There's some good people in it. I like Big Malcolm McDowell. I like the kid that's really obsessed with snow. We'll get to him.
Snow kid.
There's a bunch of people. There's a bunch of good, like, secondary characters in it.
Yep.
The main kid,
Finn is the name of the character. Finn yeah. Baxter.
Yes, yeah, so we're not following the McAllisters.
Nope.
We're with the Baxter family, and the film kicks off. You thought that, like, the last one kicked off at breakneck speed. In this one, the logo, Home Alone, the Holiday Heist, just whips on screen as quick as it possibly can. It just goes woo, straight in, woo, straight out, straight into the film. They're driving through snow, so we're doing better than we did last
yeah.
time when the film was done in South Africa in the middle of, like, the summer in the middle of a desert.
The opening of this film is the exact opening, shot for shot. It's a shot for shot remake of the opening of The Shining. We've got a helicopter tracking over the mountains, a long winding road, and the car worming its way while the you know, very unusual choice of music for a kid's film, plays underneath. It's already setting a super duper eerie tone. And, you know, the Baxters, they're doing this shot-for-shot remake of The Shining. They're moving through the mountains. They're moving from California. They're moving to a different state. Tom, where are they moving?
I could not believe this. That, like, it takes about 5 minutes to get to it, like, in the film. They established the characters. You got Finn Baxter. He's like your young Kevin McAllister type. He's really obsessed with video games. We've got the dad, who is fake Jason Bateman, Chris Parnell. And then we've got the mum. She is the reason they're moving to this as yet unnamed state. She has got a new job. That's causing them to relocate. They get loads more money. It's really good. She's excited about it, but the kids aren't. We've got the daughter Alexis, and she is your quintessential grumpy teen. She's always on her phone, always on her headphones. No, not headphones, earbuds. Fuck you.
I wrote that down. There's a bit where the mum is like, "Can you take those headphones off?" And she goes, "Oh, they're earbuds."
And she's like, "Oh, I hate this kid." Anyway, the kids are not very happy to be moving to this unnamed snowy state, and they go, "Hey kids, welcome to Maine, the home of everything evil in Stephen King's mind, where so much of his shit is set." I was eating my breakfast while I was watching this, and I stopped with, like, the spoon halfway in my mouth and looked at the television as if to say, "You what?" And rewound it, because I was just like, no. It's in Stephen King land.
Literally, on one of our earlier episodes, Tom, you said to me, "Oh, is one of these films going to be set in Maine because of all of the Stephen King references?"
Exactly.
They listened.
Oh, fuck, this is eerie.
This is creepy.
Yeah.
And that is not the only creepy thing, because straight off the bat, they are, for some reason, trying to make this movie the scary one.
Yes, there's a whole thing running through about ghosts.
Ghosts and fear and facing your fears. Because they turn up at their house in Maine. It's a perfectly normal looking, nice house. And they turn up and Finn, the kid, gets out the car and he looks at his new house and he's horrified. He's like, "Ugh, it's so creepy." It's a totally normal looking house.
Yeah, and the sister is trying to wind him up and makes him really freak out. And you're kind of like, I feel like he's a little bit too old to be believing in, like, there's literally ghosts in your house and all this kind of shit. And, like, this film kind of delivers on the promise of, you know, in the first Home Alone, the spooky boiler that means absolutely fuck all and that John Hughes blatantly forgot about.
Yeah.
This is what would happen if they actually pursued that idea of, like, you're at home on your own and you think that the house is haunted.
Yeah. Oh,
it's
yeah.
It's weird. It's weird.
It's weird. I mean, don't get me wrong, buddy. I quite liked it.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah.
but, yeah, so it's this whole motif about he thinks the house is haunted by the previous owner, Jimmy Deadleg Gravano. He was called Deadleg for some reason. He was a bootlegger. He lived in the house and he sold his bootleg hooch. And then somebody smothered him in his sleep.
Yeah, he was murdered in the house. He had a deformed leg, which is why he was called Deadleg. So he would drag it around with him.
And then if anyone falls asleep in the house, so they say, his ghost will seek revenge on all who sleep there by smothering them. This isn't one of those riffs that me and Tom are going off on. It's not, this isn't anything
this is
to do with the Yellow King.
This is a part of the story, yeah.
This is in the film.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fucked up!
It's really weird, isn't it? It kind of creates... it definitely gives the film a slightly Goonies-esque thing because the crux of the film is people are trying to find... They're trying to find One-Eyed Willie's treasure. They're trying to find Deadleg's treasure, which is hidden in the bottom, in the Baxter's house that they've just bought. Now, who wants that treasure?
Well, we've got a little gang of goons, much like it's a little bit reminiscent of Home Alone. I want to say 3. It was 3, wasn't it? Right,
with the
Gabriel
spy.
Burns.
Yeah, the Gabriel Burns. Yes. So we've got Mr. Hughes, who is a dim-witted safecracker. Who the actor was in. My Name Is Earl.
He's Crabman, I believe.
Yes. He's
Which
Crabman.
Is second references to Crabman in this franchise.
Fucking hell, this is terrifying.
So there's
Jessica, and she's like a security and surveillance person, and they've both been hired by Sinclair, played by Malcolm McDowell. And Malcolm McDowell's like, he's like, right, here's the plan, guys. We've got to break into this house, which, as far as he knows, is not being inhabited. He doesn't know it's been sold yet, but he knows this is meant to be the last whereabouts of Deadleg. And that in Deadleg's basement, there is like a secret safe. There's a secret hideaway from his bootlegging days. And hidden within that is the treasure that they want to get. And the treasure is a fucking crazy treasure to have in a kid, like in a Home Alone film. It's an Edvard Munch painting.
Yeah, it is a painting called The Widow by Edvard Munch, who is the Norwegian painter famous for doing The Scream. He painted 4 different versions of The Scream. You may know one or more of them. And for some reason, Malcolm McDowell really, really wants this painting.
He's like, we're going to go and get it because it's worth an absolute shit ton of money and it's been lost for over 100 years. It's like, okay, cool. All right, I'm on board with this at this point. I think that, like, you've got, like, the quite repellent children characters. So, like, that's, like, present and correct for a Home Alone film. Because, the main kid is... Ugh, he's annoying. He fluctuates between being passable and fine and just, like, really grating, which seems to fluctuate with, like, how his character traits are. Like, so Finn is obsessed with video games. He's also terrified of ghosts. Seems a little bit too old for that. Like,
and he won't leave the house to go and make new friends because he's scared of, like, social interaction.
Yeah, but then, like, there is a point in this film where I think there must be... Somebody must, who's making this film, thought that this was the point where he conquered his fears and started challenging them, because he suddenly just becomes very outgoing and really wisecracky, very outdoorsy, making traps and stuff. And it's like his character just suddenly flips.
Well, there's a very, very good reason for that, Tom.
Oh, I imagine there is.
So, you know, don't worry. I was I was a bit in the dark about it myself at the time, but on the walk here to meet you, it's a rainy night here in tropical Brighton, UK, and the realisation sort of hit me so sharply that I had to stop on the street and get my notebook out and start drawing diagrams and Googling dates and connecting things, connecting the dots through the looking glass, piecing all the pieces of the puzzle together. So now I have it and I understand, but I won't tell you yet.
Okay, great. I look forward to this. So yeah, like, Finn's a bit of a dick. Alexis is also a dick. Like, she's kind of like an older... She's an older teen than, like, you normally get in these films. And she is just...
She's got some great lines.
She is kind of great.
She's so mean to the dad. Yeah. And, like, I love that the dad's got dynamic because, like, the dad calls his son dude and he's just, like, does, like, these crazy British accents and stuff. And he goes to the daughter, Alexis, and is like, hey, you want to help us unpack? And she goes, I'd rather die.
Oh, and there's this heartbreaking scene where, like, the dad is, like, unpacking stuff and he comes up to him and is like, hey, look, it's your old karaoke machine. And you want to sing a song? She's like, I haven't played with that in a million years. Go away, you're embarrassing me. And then he's just there with this karaoke machine going, I love you, daddy. You're so annoying. And it's just, like, this desperate man trying to get affection from his children, and it's, and just, he is tanking it out there. He is dying on his ass, and it's just like, oh my god. And also because you love the dad so much because he's like just such a likable character, and it's just kind of like, oh, this poor man, this poor man, because he does it with Finn as well. It's like, hey Finn, we could go camping and stuff, and he's just like, fuck you, I want to go play video games.
Yeah, and even his wife doesn't seem particularly fond of him. She's, like, moved the whole family out there for her job. She's super concerned about the
job. She's under a lot of stress.
She's under some stress, but he's sort of like, hey, don't worry, you know, we all love you, we've all followed you here. And she's like, okay, cool, good. That's fine, that's all I needed to know. Good night. No sort of, I feel for him. My heart goes out to him.
It gets even worse for him because Finn is terrified of there being a ghost.
Yeah, and the ghost of dead leg.
So he sets up a trap in his bedroom. And for some reason, the dad just goes into his bedroom in the middle of the night.
This was never explained why the dad was going into the bedroom in the middle of the night.
Yeah. And when the son, when the dad goes into the bedroom, the trap that his son has set up, somehow his son has gotten hold of a taser.
And the mum is like, you're not supposed to play with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right, but neither are you.
Stun guns? Oh, you shouldn't be playing with these. Like, what, you just left these? These were in, like, the boxes, your packing boxes, with, like, the video game controllers and, like, the books. And, like, what? Yeah, that's some next level shit.
Yeah, and all of this is basically because double fake Gabriel Byrne, a.k.a. Malcolm McDowell and his crew, they want to get into the house to get the painting, which they know is hidden in there somewhere. And Finn Baxter is convinced that every time they try and get in...
It's a ghost.
So this is the ghost of Deadleg trying to get out.
Yeah. And the first thing that happens is the family all go out and have, like, a super perky Christmas montage to go and buy a Christmas tree and all this kind of shit and, like, you know, get to Low Maine. And during this, the Malcolm McDowell gang, they go and break in, and he's like, his helpers are not very good. Crabman is not, like, very stealthy. He, like, eats cookies and drags mud into the house, and they leave a lot of evidence that they've been there. And so when Finn comes back, he's like, oh, fuck, fucking hell, there's, like, there's ghosts. There's actually, like, it's proving to him that there are ghosts. And, like, the Malcolm McDowell gang, they get in there and they can't get out. They don't have enough time to get the painting. They find the hidden safe that's in the basement. They crack into that, but they don't realise there's a secret door through the safe into One-Eyed Willie's lair. So they're like, oh, we've got to come back, says Malcolm McDowell in his gruff little hat. And as he leaves, he bangs his foot, which then means he becomes Deadleg. They have this weird-ass scene in this hardware store where, like, Malcolm McDowell's like, oh, I've really knackered my foot, so I need to go and buy one Wellington boot, like a one rubber boot, and then, like, a load of, like, wood and chains and stuff to kind of, like, sturdy up his foot.
I guess he can't just go to the hospital because they'd be like, how did you hurt your foot? And he'd have to go, I was robbing a house. Oh, no!
Cursed by my own... nature, like truthful nature.
Yeah.
So he creates this kind of like that thing of if you bust your foot, you've got to wear the big boot.
Yeah.
He makes his own one, but that gives him this like spooky ass limp, and he's like clanking along everywhere.
It's the scary noise, and you see the shadow. Yeah, and it's like good. It's pretty scary, man.
Yeah, and in when he's in the hardware store buying his rubber boots, he also tells his gang what the importance is of the painting.
Yes, so Malcolm McDowell claims that the Edvard Munch painting, The Widow, is of his great grandmother called Gigi, who he very creepily calls his beloved Gigi. Yeah. So could he have known his great grandmother that much to feel that strongly? I mean, I get it, like, not for it to become his whole, like, burning life obsession.
No, it's, I mean, it's weird that it is his great grandmother, but the introduction of, like, there's this personal connection to why the baddie in a Home Alone film wants to break into the house that isn't about money. I was kind of like, I was on Malcolm McDowell's side with this. I was like, oh, I hope he, you know, I want him to get his painting. He's not like, you know, Joe Pesci and Daniel Stern. He's not like all of those Gabriel Burns. They're just doing that for their own, like, to be made wealthy. He wants to be connected with a piece of his family, a piece of his heart, his soul.
Yeah, it's a painting of his great-grandmother. It just so happens that it's painted by world-famous Edvard Munch and is worth $85 million. And it shows that he doesn't give a fuck about money, because you know how much he offers to pay Crabman and Lady Crabman for helping him out?
Mm.
He offers them each 25%. And I did the maths. That means that for helping him break into this one suburban house, and they're shit at it, by the way, they're each getting 21.25 mil.
That is crazy. But then it's also like this whole thing, like, it's obvious that he's almost just told them, like, oh, I need to get my beloved Gigi, I need my painting because I've got this strong family connection to it. And they don't twig for ages that they're kind of like, oh, he obviously really wants this painting to keep. It's like, then why are we doing it? Because we thought we were doing this to sell.
Oh, yeah. So there wouldn't be any money to...
Yeah, exactly. And it takes them so long to figure this shit out. I was just kind of like, oh, hang on a minute. There's a bit of a plot hole here. When is the penny going to drop?
It literally just dropped for me.
Oh, okay. Well, there we go. Well, I'm happy to help.
So this is the backdrop for everything. Meanwhile, there's like a weird sort of concurrent plot, which is like the children's equivalent of a love interest almost, which is the potential unrequited best friendship of Finn and the kid next door that's obsessed with snow.
He's always outside behind a fort made of snow. I'm into him.
Yeah, and like Finn is struggling to connect with him because like the kid only likes snow, Finn only likes video games.
Yeah.
But, like, he needs a friend, so it's a will they, won't they of becoming, like, best mates.
Yeah, and there's a bit, it's like, hey, man, do you want to play with some snow? It's like, no, I've got to go and fortify my house because some art thieves are going to come and, like, break into the secret compartment in the basement. And the guy's like, okay, cool, maybe you tomorrow then. And it's like, yeah, cool. The writing, and it's like, it's quite nice. There's some nice little moments.
Yeah. And so then the big kind of turning point in a way is that the mum and dad have to go to her new boss's Christmas party.
Yes, on his private mountain.
He owns a mountain, this dude. And he's such a sick bro. So he's played by Ed Asner, who this
dude
time...
Dude from Up.
He is the dude from Up, yes. Even more festive than that, he plays Santa in Elf.
There you go.
So a lot of our listeners may be in the festive mood. If you've recently watched Elf, it's fucking Santa. In this, he's old.
He's funny.
And he is fucked off his face. He's got so many funny lines. And he's like, oh, you know, can't have kids around here with all those clutching little hands. And he's like got this weird like party in like a Twin Peaks style Black Lodge cabin, where all of the waiters are dressed like Santa, and he prides himself on the fact they've all got real beards.
Yeah, and there's a nice moment with him and the dad where he thinks that the dad is his butler, and it then later transpires that the butler is dead, and he just thinks that the butler has come back from the grave, and then he's like, have you ever thought about going into the world of being a manservant? The dad's just kind of like, I don't know. What's the pay?
Yeah. I just really want to watch like a little one-act play that's just the the fucking the boss guy and the dad, like, just waiting for a bus and chatting or something. I love that. And then we cut between this party because they get snowed in.
They get snowed in. And the reason the kids don't want to go because they're being little dicks. Like, we don't like living in Maine. There's, like, clowns that keep on trying to eat us. This is scary. So they stay home alone. Well, there's two of them.
And there's a great line where the sister is supposed to be looking after the little brother. And he's like, what am I supposed to do? And she goes, hey, you can do whatever you want. We're home alone.
Yeah.
This was made for TV. I hope that's where the ad break came in. Like,
yeah, because there are definite points in this film where you can spot where the ad break comes in.
Yeah.
And when they say that, we then... This is where, like, Finn's character really changes because, like, he's not allowed to play video games. The mum's taken away his controller. And so he then's like, well, I don't really like doing energetic things, outdoorsy things. I see, like, you know, he feels very insular. And then he suddenly just goes, well, better do some Macaulay Culkin shit.
Yeah.
He's jumping on the bed. He's eating junk food. He rolls the sled down the steps. And they do a riff on the... when Kevin is shaving and he puts the aftershave. And you're expecting him to do the...
Ah!
And he kind of goes, he looks at the camera and then just kind of goes, no, it's all right. And I like that. It's like, yeah. I like that you're subverting expectation. Well done. There's a little bit of effort gone into this one.
It's a great gag. And then, he's trying to get the battery for his video game controller because, yeah, his video game controller is powered by a AA battery. That's how they work.
Yep, definitely.
And he accidentally drops it into, the basement, the spooky dookie basement. And he's too scared to go down there and retrieve his battery. He wants to play video games, can't without the battery. So he has to get his big sister to go down there and open the door and be like, yep, there's no ghosts in here. And she only agrees on the basis that, like, she can then go to the mall and he won't tell the mum and dad about that. So they go down to the basement. While they're there, they find Dead Legs safe. And then they find the secret room behind it.
Yes.
And then at the back of it, they find Edvard Munch's The Widow hung on the wall. Now, this painting, dear listener, is creepy as balls.
Yeah, it's super, super spooky.
It's like Tim Burton painted Eva Green while he was on a massive downer. It's just like a sort of a pale porcelain lady in a black dress against like a kind of...
Surrounded by sad children.
Sad, haunted children.
On this like purpley, kind of like wispy backdrop, yeah.
Yeah, and her eyes like follow you around the room and they're just like, fuck me, this is super fucking creepy. And then Finn gets kind of freaked out and he legs it. And then Alexis is like, because Alexis goes like, boo.
Yeah.
He legs it. And then she's like, oh, that was a fucking brilliant gag. Great. Can't wait to put that on my live journal or whatever. And she accidentally sets off a little trap, which locks her in the safe.
Yes.
So very important plot point. Finn thinks that she's just fucked off to the mall, but she's actually locked in the safe.
And all this time, the baddies are rallying to come and try and break in. But Finn doesn't know this yet. He has this whole thing where he starts having an online chat with a grown man. That's kind of suddenly goes like, huh, okay, I didn't expect this film. Where are we going with this?
Well, this was quite a good gag. So whenever his mum is like, you need to make some friends, Finn, you need to make some friends. He's like, I've got a friend. I'm friends with Simon. He's who I play video games with. And it's literally just like this guy that, and he thinks he's a kid. And then there's a reveal where they start to actually chat because Finn wants to get some advice. And Simon is like a 30-year-old ginger man living in the big city somewhere. And I was convinced he might be somebody famous, that this might be like a cameo of some kind. So I looked him up. It's definitely not a cameo of anybody particularly famous, but I did discover that he's in a TV show called Todd and the Book of Pure Evil.
Sounds like your
sounds
kind
like
of
my
thing.
Kind of thing, right? I need to watch the fuck out of that.
Yeah. Wow, that's weird.
But we get this is where we get kind of the like, it's supposed to be the emotional turning point because it's kind of ass backward because the grown-up man, Simon, is like, why are you alone on Christmas? This is crazy. You shouldn't be home alone. You're a little kid. And then Finn is like, well, you're alone on Christmas as well. You're playing video games. And he's like, yeah, but video games are cool. Also, I don't have any money and I can't afford to fly home to my parents for Christmas.
Yeah, it's a weird kind of like, okay, film, where are we going to go with this?
He's the closest we're going to get to a pigeon lady, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And then we get this little bit where Finn realises that his sister is stuck in the basement. And he's like, don't worry, I'm going to get you out. And he goes to a hardware store to try and buy a chainsaw, literally. And he isn't able to buy one because he doesn't have the money.
Yeah, the
not because he is a child and you can't sell a child a chainsaw. It's because he didn't have the money.
The chainsaw he wants to buy costs $2,152.71. And he's like, all right, well, what can you give me for this? Gives him a handful of change, walks out with a bunch of string.
Yep, great. And it's during this that he overhears Malcolm McDowell and his gang saying what their plan is. And then he's like, oh, well, this is convenient. I better go home and fortify the house, and I'll keep on talking to the guy on the online chat, and the guy in the online chat will be like, will think that I'm talking about a video game. And at this point, I'm just like, bro, call the fucking police. Like, he has absolutely no reason to not call the police. And then later on, when they actually do, like, you should call the police, it's like, the mobile phone battery has died. And, like, I know, like, obviously, like, people don't have landlines, you know, like, quite so much anymore. But they might have done back then in Maine. Your mobile phone reception in all those, in the mountains, you got to have a landline.
It's important. You got to plumb that shit in. The most confusing thing I found about the trapping the house montage is that they do kind of the Looney Tunes thing of like suggesting that he's moving so fast that there's multiple versions of him. And really, so they've superimposed multiple versions of Finn in the same shot, running around doing different things. And for a minute, I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. I genuinely was like, is he twins? And I've only just now realised. And then there were like five of them. And
no, this is where his mutant power manifests and he can like create clones of himself.
Really, like, span me out.
But it's really weird. Like, the parents leave at night, they go off, all this stuff happens with like the batteries and going to the basement, the sister getting locked in back, you know, like the parents get snowed in on the mountain. He goes to the shops, he overhears Malcolm McDowell, he goes home, he fortifies the house. Part of fortifying the house is like involves baking. Like, he actually has time to make a whole set of biscuits. And it's just like, how much time is this taking? Like, unless, like, they're living, like, unless in Maine, like, the sun goes down at midday. Like, how, like, what is the time span of this? Just seems fucking weird.
Yeah, it's a bit bunched. But we get some cool moments when they actually, like, attack, when the baddies attack. Because,
okay, yeah.
Especially because Lady Malcolm McDowell and Crabman, they both also think that the house is haunted, which is really funny.
Yes.
So one of the funniest bits for me in the house is when Jessica, the lady baddie, is trying to climb in through the window, and he's rigged it so basically like the window will like slam shut on her and she like can't get in, so she's like stuck halfway in and out of the window. And when that happens, her response isn't like, ah, that's annoying. Like, it's not like, oh, I'll just lift that up and get back out again.
Yeah,
it slams down on her back and she goes, help, the house has got me. Which I thought was amazing. Like, it's literally eating her.
Yeah.
That's so scary.
Yeah.
And then while she's in there, the others are trying to pull her out by her legs. And Finn is on the roof with like a little pea shooter. And he keeps like shooting like little darts into her butt. And every time she thinks it's Malcolm McDowell and Crab Man like smacking her on the ass, and she's like, stop doing that.
And like kicks them in the
and
balls.
Kicks them in the face. But like, it's funny once, but that happens like four times.
Yeah, they keep on doing it.
I really did.
Yeah,
me.
That was a good bit. Like, I think she also just like, there's a very simple bit where she goes into a window and basically just gets kicked in the face by a stocking full of coal. And it's just as simple as someone getting kicked in the face. And it was like, yeah, you know, sometimes you don't need to overthink it. We get like there's a nice bit where like Malcolm McDowell has to climb in through an open window, and I just like there's this scene of just Malcolm McDowell acting on his own to an empty room, and he's just kind of like, you want me to be scared? I'm not scared of ghosts. There are no ghosts here. And then Finn is in the cupboard, and he's rigged the entire room so somehow that he's using a Wizard of Oz style don't look behind the curtain thing of levers and pulleys to make the room seem haunted. So like every now and then, like thrash metal will start playing and these like weird distorted images of Finn will appear on like the television in there and the lights will flicker on and off and be like, why don't you leave? And like Malcolm was like, I don't believe in you, ghost. And it's like,
yeah, and then
man, jobbing actor Malcolm McDowell must be like in his 70s. Like, yeah, fuck, this is why I like this guy.
It had to happen as well, because then the lights go out and he turns on a black light and it's just a pillow. Yeah. There's literally just a pillow hanging from the ceiling. And Malcolm McDowell has to be like, so I just, before they shot this, I just really like to imagine the director being like, okay, so when the pillow is there, and he's like, yeah, mate, yeah. He's like, I just need you to act like you're just really scared of the pillow. And he's like, yeah, can do.
Absolutely.
Like, do you not want to talk about this anymore? He's like, no, I know exactly what you mean. I know exactly what you mean. I'm Malcolm McDowell, mate. All right then, so the lights go out, the black light comes on, the pillow's there, and he looks at it, and my God, he nails it. He's like, and he fucking darts out of that room, man.
He is a pro. Yes. Ah. What else, any other good bits from this?
Well, there's a bit that I've written down and underlined, but I can't remember it now. I've just written down in quote marks, "I will ruin you."
Right. Okay. Now this is a special bit.
I can't remember that. What is it?
This bit is so good. This is when we cut back at one point to the parents in the crazy old boss's party, and he's like, we've been snowed in and we might not get out for 4 days. And then the mum is like, this is unacceptable, I need to get out of here. If that means I get fired because I need to leave and look after my family, then so be it. What? Why would you be fired for going to look? Why is your boss isn't a monster? He's just drunk off his ass. And then he's like, oh, well, I guess we could be snowed in here for 4 days, but I know some guys in the forestry department, I'm sure they can get you out. And they're driving off, and while the bad guys have been trying to get into the house, Finn keeps on talking to his grown man gamer.
Simon.
Yeah. And Simon drops a hit. Like, he's like, oh no, you're not playing a game. You're actually fighting real life baddies. You need to call the police. And then Finn's like, nah, I gotta go, I got this, bye. Puts it down. It's like, I mean, that is very contradictory to what Finn's character was like earlier on the film, but we'll just have to get past that. And then, like, we get this whole thing where, like, the gamer, he hacks Finn's account to find out the credit card on his online gaming thing so he can find out who the parents are, and somehow gets their number and phones them. And he's like, hi, I just need to tell you that your son's in danger. And the mum's like, what? What are you talking about? Who is this? It's like, oh, I'm a friend of your son. We've been talking online. And she's like, what? It's like, who are you? And he's like, okay. Oh, maybe I shouldn't have said that. The thing to remember is that your daughter is locked in the basement. And she's like, what? What the fuck? And this guy's like, oh no, I'm saying the wrong things. And then the mom is like, oh my God, I'm going to call the police. I will ruin you. And it's amazing.
That's why I wrote it down. I remember now.
So good. Like, it's like, this is what is like what I actually quite really enjoyed about this, is that like all the characters kind of have their own funny moments. Like, it's not just all about the kid. Like, so the dad and the mum have got funny moments. Like, you've obviously got the bad guys. Like, even the sister has like a good funny bit. Because,
mate, it was a lot to recount.
Because there's this whole thing where like the mum has taken away the phone from the daughter and says like, he's like, you got no phone, no internet, no TV. And then when she phones, I was like, hey, how's it going? She's like, it's fine, I'm reading. It's like, reading? It's like, okay, I'm reading a magazine article about nail polish. It's not exactly War and Peace, but I am reading. And then the capper is that when she gets locked in the basement, the only thing in there is a copy of War and Peace. And then she just spends the rest of the film reading War and Peace. Great.
It's a great gag. It's just because it's not just her like being like, huh, I guess reading is cool. The gag is kind of more about this, like, she has this like will she won't she relationship,
yes,
with the book.
Yeah.
Where she keeps looking at it and being like, am I gonna have to read you? Ugh. And then she gets it closer and she like opens it and then it's like closes it and it's like, no. And then eventually she reads it.
She's like, oh, no way.
No way. Yeah. Yeah. It's good. I liked it a lot. This is the gist, man. And then for the denouement, it all kind of comes together when Lady Gabriel Byrne Crabman, aka Jessica, gets a phone call from her estranged ex-boyfriend Steve, who she spent the whole... He used to be the gang's safecracker before they got Crabman. Right. And then they broke up. And then she's been really upset about it. And then she gets a phone call and... Snow Kid, who's obsessed with snow, he comes to the rescue, throws a snowball at her, which like drops the, which makes her be like, hey, fuck off, like you, get out of here, you, I'm sick of you. And then Steve thinks that she's talking to him.
Yes.
And she's so like distraught by the fact that she had her chance to get back together with Steve but blew it, that Snow Kid is then able to overpower her by trapping her into a giant snowman.
Yeah, it's weird, right?
So that's what happens to her.
Yeah.
While Crabman and Malcolm McDowell open up the safe to confront Alexis, who's been trapped in there. They want the painting. She's like, I will smash the painting. And he's got this really brutal line where he says, hey, a painting ripped in half can be repaired. The same cannot be said for little girls.
Yeah.
Holy shit, man. And then like he gets the painting off her and he goes, oh, Gigi. Which to me just is like, man, Malcolm McDowell wants to fuck his great-grandmother.
Yeah, right?
Like super
oh,
bad.
Oh, she was a right piece. Oh,
yeah, this creepy-looking Eva Green.
Yeah.
And then Alexis gets out with the help of Finn, who's like rigged a special double lock thing. They lock Malcolm McDowell and Crabman in the safe with the painting.
And everything's fine.
Everything's totally fine.
Yeah, like the family are happy. They get a reward for catching the bad guys. Finn is really like into living in Maine.
He gets given a video game piece of merch for Christmas, but it's a branded video game snowboard. So he gets to go out and enjoy the snow with
Snowboy.
With Snowboy, yeah.
Yeah, and that's kind of the end of it. Oh, no, the other thing that happens is the video game guy, the police raid him. They pepper spray him in the face, which is fucking hilarious.
Yeah.
And then, like, they're in a completely different city. They're not in Maine. And for some reason, Finn had set up a webcam that he's been able to hack into. So then just him and the SWAT team watch... Finn foil Malcolm McDowell while having some beers. And then Finn's mum, they give video game guy some money so he can go and see his family for Christmas. And I think this is like the most heartening Christmas ending of any of these films, because there's never, like, at the end of it, you don't have a, Kevin, you spent all this money on this kind of thing, or, you know, like, Kevin, what did you do in my room, or the Yellow King in the form of a parrot doesn't come in at the end. You don't get this horrifying bit where the sentient house creates snow in the middle of South Africa. Everyone just seems kind of happy at the end, apart from the crooks who've been imprisoned. So there's like, it's kind of like, oh, this is like the one that kind of feels like it has the most heartening Christmas ending.
And you're absolutely right, man. And it feels that way, I think, because it's so rare for a fiction film to have such a deep impact on the real world around us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think especially like at this time of year, at Christmas, we should all be thankful, so thankful for Peter Hewitt, the director of Home Alone 5, The Holiday Heist, for what he's done by making this film, which is permanently destroy the Yellow King once and for all in the real world.
In the real world?
Well, because, man, don't you understand? Don't you understand? It's all about the 1994 film Star Trek Generations.
Right. Starring Malcolm McDowell?
Starring Malcolm McDowell. That's where it all started to go wrong. Let me lay some heavy shit on you, Tom.
Okay, hit me.
Open up your brandy.
Okay.
Sit back. Here we go. Before Star Trek Generations even hit cinema screens in 1994, sometime after 1990, here's what would have happened. This is really when things kind of turned dark. It began in Canada. Canadian Thanksgiving. Okay. Either, I can't tell who, one of these two great Canadians, Catherine O'Hara or John Candy, both Canadian, they would have gone home for Canadian Thanksgiving. One of them, I just, the evil of the Yellow King by portraying him on screen, I just think it bled into the real world, man. And one of them, in our life outside of the films, had that touch of evil.
This is like a Wes Craven's New Nightmare thing.
We're going totally meta, right?
Yeah.
Wes Craven's New Nightmare, Bride of Chucky, Home Alone 5, The Holiday Heist. Right. In our life, outside of the movie, this happened. They had that evil. And then while home for Canadian Thanksgiving, one of them would have, at some party or something, seen, bumped into, had a drink with other fellow Canadian, William Shatner.
Ooh, okay.
Passed the curse to the Shatman.
Oh my God.
Right. So, cast your mind forward. 1994, the set of Star Trek Generations. At this point, I'd like to shout out friend of the podcast, Liam, who does the Spocklight podcast. I'm sure he noticed the exact same thing. William Shatner's fucking evil, man. He's the Yellow King. On set of Star Trek Generations, he is somehow passes that curse on to Malcolm McDowell.
Malcolm, no!
Well, exactly. I think he maybe just knew that, like, his days were numbered, time was running out. But that then frees William Shatner, and he, like, wakes as if from a dream. Oh, my God, was that real? Was that not? 2 years later, he's, like, vaguely aware. It's like, you know, in It, where the kids grow up, and they're like, we've got to go back and do something about that thing when we were kids.
Dude.
Like, we've got to go back and do something about that. He has this conversation with a little guy called French Stewart on the set of Third Rock from the Sun, which then prompts French to go and be in Home Alone 4 as a way of kind of mobilizing the Hollywood forces to sort of stealth that story in and, like, get in the back door. So people see it, they understand about the Yellow King, and they're like, fuck, man, we've got to stop this. So here's what they do. They get onto Peter Hewitt, right?
Yeah.
Peter Hewitt, director of Home Alone 5, The Holiday Heist. Okay? There's two things you've got to know about Peter Hewitt. One is he had a passion project for a really long time in his back pocket. It was a screenplay, he couldn't get it made. Before he did Home Alone 5, The Holiday Heist, he was working on the screenplay for a movie called The Heist. I've seen it, it's fucking brilliant. It is about Morgan Freeman trying to steal a painting. Okay? So they say to him, look, we've got a heist movie that you can make. I know it's not your one that you've been working on, but it's good practice for that. Like, you can use a lot of the same kind of plot elements and work it out. He's like, fine, that's fine, but why are you doing all this nice stuff for me? Why me? It's like, well, it's because of your background on the previous film you directed, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, the film that is set largely in hell itself.
Damn.
One of my all-time favourite depictions of the architecture of hell. Those hallways of hell and the inferno in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, it's chilling. This is what earned him the right to direct Home Alone 5, The Holiday Heist, okay?
Yeah.
The fact that he had this experience of depicting hell on screen. And I'll tell you why, Tom. So, the heist in The Holiday Heist is this Edvard Munch painting, The Widow, okay? So, I don't know how much you know about Edvard Munch. He's Norwegian, incredibly troubled. Certainly not a great ladies man. Like, he never married, didn't really have any great love interests. I read his whole Wikipedia page. Certainly not that believable that he would be in love with Malcolm McDowell's great-grandmother enough to paint this portrait. In fact, I looked through his Wikipedia page and I checked all 1,700 paintings that he did in his lifetime. Not one of them is called The Widow.
Okay.
So this painting has been erased from history. Either it didn't exist in the first place, or it's so important that we're not supposed to know about it.
Right.
And the reason for that is, Edvard Munch, like I said, very troubled. In 1903, he did paint a self-portrait called Self-Portrait in Hell.
Damn.
And it's a really dark, brutal picture of himself with his face blacked out against a bright yellow background.
I see.
Now,
okay.
You know what that means. During his troubled times, during the darkest hour of when he was literally losing his mind, repeatedly painting The Scream over and over again, other paintings of like dead children and things like that he did, he went to hell. Like, he went to the darkest parts of himself. While he was there, he saw something he shouldn't have seen, Tom. He saw the Yellow King's real face.
Oh, shit.
Outside of anybody's body, outside of any body swapping, the Yellow King's real face. And when he got back, he painted it. And it's the Widow. It's this kind of black widow character surrounded by all her dark children. And it had to be erased from all of the history books. Like, nobody will talk about this outside of this film. And they had to do all of this the whole filming of this movie, the whole, like, everything, the script, it's a honeypot to try and get Malcolm McDowell, the actor, possessed by the Yellow King, into a very specific place at a very specific time where they can kill him once and for all. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying Malcolm McDowell is evil, I'm just saying he's been evil since 1994.
Right, okay.
Because there's a very important quote that the great Edvard Munch said once about his art. And I quote,
"Fear of life is necessary to me. Without anxiety, I'm a ship without a rudder. My sufferings are my art. They are indistinguishable from me, and their destruction would destroy my art."
Now, don't forget that his art, in this case, is this painting, which is also the Yellow King's true self.
Mm.
How do you destroy Edvard Munch's art? By destroying fear. You destroy fear, you destroy the art. You destroy the art, you destroy the Yellow King. Well, we already established at the start of the film that Finn is afraid of life. He won't go outside, he won't go in social situations.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He won't embrace life, he won't make new friends. So suddenly, in the middle of the film, for no reason at all, he stops being afraid. Very, very shortly afterwards, Malcolm McDowell is in a set that they have built, which is basically a prison when he's in the safe.
Yeah.
He's in the safe. And there's no way they could do that set without him walking into it. There's no sort of third wall or anything like that. He walks in, he picks up the picture, which is the Yellow King's true self. Then Peter Hewitt, the director, and all of the other cast, they're like, "Lock the door, lock the door, keep the cameras rolling, lock the door." They lock the door, he picks it up, and then Finn runs out, and it's like, "I'm not afraid anymore. Look, I'm gonna go and make friends with this kid over the road. We're gonna go snowboarding. Look, I'm not afraid, I'm not afraid. Fear of life is gone. That destroys the art. The painting is destroyed. While Malcolm McDowell is holding it, his true face is gone. Yellow King, deceased." It's a Christmas miracle. Malcolm McDowell is now free of the nightmare, free to be himself. So, like, once he, I'm really sorry to say, but any movies Malcolm McDowell made between 1994 and 2012 weren't really him. They were the Yellow King. But from now on, he's free. And then as a reward, Peter Hewitt got to make the heist.
Yes!
So we're seeing some people making a movie, but they're not really making a movie, right? They're saving us all. I, for one, would like to thank them.
Yeah, man. I see that because I was trying to really unpick what was going on in this film. And I also felt that this film was the fall of the Yellow King.
Yeah!
And the way I was interpreting it, and this may still also, like, not in the real world, but within the film universe, that we are still meant to be, if we're following on from where we left off in part three, that we're in the hellscape that repeats forever and ever and ever and ever, and then slowly degrades and things become weird and off. We are still there, and the Yellow King is the boss who lives in the private mountain.
Oh, wow!
Because he's given the John Candy moment where the mum needs to get somewhere. Yeah. But he is now old and he is dilapidated. He doesn't know what the fuck is going on. And instead of saying, the tit for tat, like taking the soul in exchange for something, he just lets her go. He just lets her go. And also the agents of evil in the film, in this one, the community is working together. That, like, Finn is helping his sister. She is in on the trap. We have the video game guy. We have the snowball kid. We have, like, the denizens of the hellscape. They are fighting back. And I feel that is put into the film universe as a sort of, like, a hidden fuck you to the real-life Yellow King trapped in the real-life Malcolm McDowell.
Well, so of course.
They're taunting him. They're like, "We know that your power is waning, that no empire can last forever."
Yeah, exactly. And that's why they would have... So the character of Ed Asner, for example, the millionaire boss of the crazy, they had to make him so fucking, like, clearly mental and weird and evil so that when the Yellow King got that screenplay from Malcolm McDowell's agent, he'd be like, yeah, sure, I'll do this.
But he doesn't...
Because I like this. I like this vibe you're putting
out.
But
then he doesn't see it. He doesn't see it. Like, he still has delusions of what his power is, but his power has spread so far and is now spread so thin.
Yeah.
That is allowed in the world of the film, the people of that world, of the hellscape, to rise up against evil and have a good Christmas. In tandem with the real-life vanquishing exorcism of the Yellow King from Malcolm McDowell's body. It all adds up.
It all adds up. And honestly, if Malcolm McDowell is listening, I really, really... I've got just some questions. Can he remember the years between 1994 and 2012?
When did Tank Girl come out? Was that...
I feel like that was maybe within the control period of the Yellow King.
Yeah.
And that... I, for one, am going to sleep so soundly tonight knowing that he's not a part of our lives anymore.
And it's a really beautiful resolution to this hellish franchise. I mean, it's a Christmas miracle.
It's a Christmas miracle, you guys. And I do urge you to Google the Edvard Munch painting Self-Portrait in Hell, because it will really give you the willies.
Yeah. I would also say, if you're the kind of person who feels compelled to watch more than the first two Home Alone films, this is the one that you go and watch after that. Because it's a triumph of humanity, really.
I loved the last gag, which we haven't even mentioned, which is all about Edvard Munch.
Yes!
Where they're saying, it's the lovable dad is trying to explain to the kids. He's like, hey, we got this reward because in the basement there they found... This painting by Edvard Munch.
And he did The Scream.
He did The Scream, and Finn's like, never heard of it. And the dad is like, you know, The Scream. And he puts his hands on either side of his face and goes, ah! And the kid's like, he's like, I don't get it. And then the mum is next to him and goes, ah! And they're both doing it. And then you think, is he gonna? And then Finn goes, no, I'm not doing that.
I love how they're poking fun at, like, the mac and cheese
hand
slap scream. And it was a lovely little end. Yeah.
I know, and you can only get to that, like, really lovely moment because they must have been feeling so good on set, because rarely can you make a film like Home Alone 5 and actually literally change the world. But by the time they were filming those end scenes, they're like,
definitely.
Malcolm's back. Like, the actor Malcolm McDowell
must have just, like... You know, like, he's a treasure, and now he's back, he's working.
He would have been rubbing his eyes, being like, where am I? The last thing I remember is I was on the Starship Enterprise, and now what's going on?
I know.
They're like, sit down, Malcolm, have a brandy, we've got a lot to tell you.
You've been gone so long, we're so glad to have you back.
And that's why there's that really jubilant vibe at the end. Ding dong, the king is dead.
Well, that, I think, about does it.
That is the bitter end of the Home Alone franchise, and that is almost the bitter end of Season 8.
Yes, so we will be back next time for the wrap-up, where we're going to be talking about this franchise as a whole and some of the other areas where Home Alone has seeped into the wider world, and just look at some other little bits and pieces about this franchise so we can tuck it into bed and say, thank you, Yellow King. May you burn forever.
I just want to take a moment to say thank you very much for listening this far. I hope you've enjoyed it, even though we're not quite done yet. Thanks for getting in touch. So many of you guys have been getting in touch and like sharing your theories about the Yellow King and your totally wrong theories about whether or not Die Hard is a Christmas movie. I'm loving it, you guys. So please do keep dropping us a line. You can reach us on Twitter at BitterEndPod or on Facebook at BitterEndPod.
And until next time, I'm Tom Denny.
I'm Todd Jordan.
And we're free and we get Malcolm back.